This is Where Did the Road Go? Our aim is to explore the fringe, to be true skeptics and question openly, to investigate the paranormal, bring light to the dark corners of history, and give a voice to the shunned of science. We deal in mystery and the important questions that these subjects bring to light. What is reality? Who are we? And why are we here? Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com for a full show archive, links to all our social media, upcoming schedule, and much, much more. Now, join your host Soraya on this week's edition of Where Did the Road Go?
And welcome to this week's show. Tonight we're going to be talking with Nick Redfern, and I also want to remind people that we have our Patreon account set up. If you go to wheredidtheroadgo.com, you can become a patron of the show for only $3, and that's going to entitle you to extra content. There's two things up now, and I'm going to keep adding to it, just short little extra bits from guests that's not included in the main interview. All the interviews will always be free. And the archive will always be free. But we're trying to add more shows, and we're trying to add a lot more content. There'll be a member section eventually for patrons. And if you don't want to use the patron thing, you can use PayPal as well. So, always contact us with questions. Again, everything is on wheredidtheroadgo.com. And tonight, as I said, Mr. Nick Redfern. Are you there, Nick?
Hey, Soraya.
So it's been a while since you've been on. I think it was last September or so last time I talked to you.
Yeah, I think it was a little bit more than a year ago, so it probably would have been about September, yeah.
And you have at least three books out since then.
Well, yeah, I do actually, but it's not like they've all been sort of written at the same time. One of them was actually completed about a year ago, one about 6 months ago, and then the other one only about 2 months ago, but based on sort of the schedules of different publishers. You know, one might hang on to a book for a year before they publish it. Another one wait a few months, and then another one might say, you know, we want to put it out in a few weeks. So, and coincidentally, they've all sort of come out between sort of September and November, which does look like, you know, I've been sort of writing them all together in one, you know, burning the candle at both ends 24/7. But, you know, it's actually not the case. Two of them have sort of been sat on the shelves for, you know, a while before they finally get released.
Right. And the this one that we're going to talk about tonight, Bloodline of the Gods, that came out on New Page, and I think maybe just a few weeks later your other Men in Black book came out.
Yeah, that's right. But the writing for the Bloodline of the Gods book, that was actually finished in, I think, something like February of this year. But the Men in Black book, that writing wasn't finished until maybe 3 weeks before it was put out, it was published. You know, they got that book out really fast. Hmm. But as I said, the New Page book was handed over in February, and the other one I've got out right now, the Chupacabra Road Trip, that was actually finished in December of last year, so that was like 12 months ago, and that's only just come out as well. And that's sort of it gives you like a bit of a insight, I guess, into how the publishing world works. You know, there's no sort of mystery about it. What it typically comes down to is that, you know, if a publisher has maybe five or six books in front of yours that are already, you know, been accepted and edited and they're designing the cover and everything else, then your book goes behind all those. However, if the publisher, you know, doesn't have any new books ready to go, then yours comes out quicker. You know, it just depends where you are in the line as far as how many books they've got to publish, you know.
Right. Well, yeah, and it just to the outside view, like I got this one, and then saw your Men in Black book, and I'm like, what? You pop them out every couple of weeks now?
Yeah. No. Yeah. I mean, even though I can't sort of do it like that. It's I like to sort of stick to 8 to 5 Monday to Friday, and because I think if you sort of overstretch yourself, you know, you just get fried and frazzled doing it, and then you just have to go back and correct it all because, you know, you're sort of either racing to get it done, or as like you said, you're just fried. And that, if you're going to do that, I mean, you don't do your best work anyway, and it's inevitable you're just going to have to go back and rehash it and look at it again. So I find that working on one book at a time, just doing 8 to 5 Monday to Friday, you know, which is the way I like to do it, then that way you don't get burned out and you sort of stay focused, but I mean, I do have some friends who, you know, literally can sort of juggle four books at a time, but you know, I've been a couple of times when I've had to do that, but it's not much fun. Because, like I said, it just doesn't work well to do that, at least for me. You know, I like to sort of focus on one, get that project finished, and then move on to another. You know, it's kind of like a band expecting them to record, you know, 3 CDs, you know, with 12 songs across 6 months. It's not going to work, you know.
Yeah, yeah. And if it does work, it's not going to be the best quality.
No, that's right, yeah.
So... all right, so this book, Bloodline of the Gods, deals mostly with the Rh negative factor in human blood, which I had never really examined much. I mean, I'd heard references to it here and there, but never really thought much about it. What gave you the impetus to start this?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's a controversial story, and one of the reasons why I decided to write the book actually gets to the crux of what you just said about, you know, you hadn't heard too much about it. And that's one of the things when I'm writing a book, I always try and, you know, focus on something that probably hasn't been covered that much in a book before. Because if, you know, if you're going to write a book and people are going to buy them, you want to be able to give them something new. And so that's one of the things I always look for when I'm writing a book, is to try and come up with a new angle or a new subject. And so, you know, you always kind of look at it carefully and think, well, you know, is this a good one? Is that a good one? And, you know, when you just said you hadn't heard much about it, well, one of the things I found was that a lot of people within ufology had not heard of this so-called Rh blood factor. As it relates, the scenarios it relates to is because a small percentage of the human population have what's called Rh negative blood, and the rest of us have what's called Rh positive. Well, one of the interesting things is a lot of Rh negatives have had UFO encounters, and so it sort of gives rise to the idea that, you know, is there a connection with the UFO phenomenon and the Rh negatives? And so that was sort of the idea, or that's the background to it. And I thought, well, you know, it hasn't really been done before. And granted, it's a controversial subject, and there's, you know, there's certainly nothing wrong about writing about controversial issues. You know, there's no point just going over old ground and play it safe. You might as well just share something new and intriguing with people. But it's one of these areas that, because it focuses on the present and the distant past, you know, sort of by default, when you're dealing with things that are thousands of years old, you know, to a degree, you're dealing with sort of concepts and theories, rather than if you're dealing with something like, you know, first-hand interviews today. But it's sort of a very different scenario when you're sort of looking back potentially thousands of years to try and make a case, if you like.
Yeah, and at that point, it becomes a lot of mythology and interpretation.
Well, yeah, and that's one of the big problems. You know, even I, and, you know, I'm quite open to having to admit this, that, you know, it's like with the whole ancient astronaut scenario, which of probably about 35% of the book is focused upon that angle before it gets into the modern era. But, you know, where I hopefully, you know, point out to people, I think when you're looking at the whole ancient astronaut's angle, a lot of people will tell you, well, this is what's happening and this is how it goes, and, you know, ABC 1 2 3. It's very structured, and it's presented from the perspective of the relevant author being absolutely sure that this is what's going on. But, you know, as I point out, we're dealing with theories and concepts and ideas which have been interpreted from ancient texts, which themselves have been interpreted and translated, you know, and rewritten by people who weren't there at the time. And so in that sense, you know, we are to a degree forced to speculate upon the speculations of people who came before us. But I think if you point that out to people, as we're sort of doing now, and you demonstrate that even though we're dealing with speculative material, you then go out and look for stuff that you can hopefully find that will corroborate it, then I think that's okay. You know, I think, but when you try and force feed it down somebody's throat and say, I know this is the truth, you know, that's when people become unstuck. I think the best we can do is present the data and let's just see where it all leads. Let's see if it opens doors and gets other people interested and more data can surface rather than sort of force feeding it down that this is the, you know, this is where it begins, this is where it ends, and, you know, this is the full story, which, you know, it clearly isn't, you know.
And you take a bit here from Zachariah Sitchin's work, and I've always been kind of torn on Sitchin. I mean, I know there are people, like there's the Sitchin is Wrong page where he points out all the misinterpretations, and we know he kind of like filled in the gaps with stuff he just sort of made up to make it all make sense. But you went back and looked at the original writings, correct?
Well, yeah, this is the big issue. I mean, you know, certainly when people talk about ancient aliens today, you know, there's no doubt that sort of the most popular scenarios sort of relate to the whole angle of the Anunnaki that was, you know, sort of Sitchin's major area of that he's known for, at least. I mean, he covered a lot of areas. There's no doubt that that's the one area more than any other that he, you know, has focused upon. Now, there's also no doubt that if you read Sitchin's work, which is, you know, based on interpretations of the original, you know, texts that have been translated into English, etc., etc., and that's all any of us can really do is sort of, you know, it's kind of like the Bible, you know, some people think, you know, it was written in English. Of course it wasn't written in English, you know, but and of course you have translations and retranslations and deletions and things like that. And then, of course, I think it's inevitable that whichever era you're in, you tend to sort of speculate and interpret based around, you know, what we perceive is going on today. For example, you know, you might read in an ancient biblical text about a fiery chariot or something like that. Well, today we interpret that, or a lot of people do, as like a UFO. But that's because, you know, we're in an era when people talk about UFOs, so we relate it to something. And I think that's, you know, even I would have to admit, that's the one danger when it comes to interpreting these old texts like Sitchin did. You know, there's nothing wrong with trying to look at it and come to a valid conclusion or a theory, providing, like I said, we take that view. So what I did for the reader was to look at Sitchin's theories and what other people felt about his theories, primarily because there is like a tie-in between what he said and the Rh negative factor. And, you know, had there not been that, I wouldn't have, you know, mentioned him, primarily because I would have just sort of used the whole ancient astronaut angle in general. You know, I wouldn't have been so specific to his theories about the Anunnaki. But the one reason why I did was because one of the sort of primary areas that Sitchin focused on was this angle of the Anunnaki sort of creating a genetically altered type of early human. You know, that was allegedly used as a slave race and so forth. That's sort of one of the key factors in his version of events. Now, the whole Rh negative factor as it relates to the UFO phenomenon is also suggestive of genetic manipulation. And there's sort of like a crossover between early humans who were Rh negative, which ties in with today's Rh negatives. And so that's how you can make sort of a connection with Sitchin. However, you know, even I will admit that it's, you know, I wouldn't say it's necessarily tenuous to the point of not being able to be proved. I think it's interesting, and I think if it's interesting, we should talk about it and address it. Now, it may lead somewhere, it may not, you know, and but I think the important thing is we get the data out for people to see and see where it leads.
Right, and let them kind of make up their own mind on it.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, that's what I've tried to do is, you know, I in all the books I write, I try and share data and share information I've found and share interviews that I've done with people that hopefully put some sort of coherent picture together. What I try not to do is to sort of, you know, sort of thump on the table and say, hey, this is what's going on. You know, this, I know for sure this is the case. Anybody in ufology who says for sure that they know what the truth is, they're either lying, fantasizing, or deluding themselves because, you know, nobody does know. But if we knew, me and you wouldn't be having this show right now, you know.
Exactly.
I wouldn't be writing books and nobody else would be writing books. We're writing books and having shows and discussing things precisely because we don't know. And so I think it's important to theorize and look at concepts and ideas, providing, like I said, we're honest enough to admit that they are concepts and ideas and theories, you know. And I think when you cross that barrier, you know, it's like if you want to write a book about the history of the U.S. American Civil War, well, we can do that based solely on facts. We know it happened. We know where the battles were. We know who the commanders on each side were, what weapons they used, etc. That's all 100% fact. But when you're dealing with something like this, you either don't write about it, or you write about it and you do, but you do so in a way which demonstrates that, you know, you're sort of looking at concepts and ideas and interweaving it with concepts that other people have come up with, but showing the reader that they are, you know, their ideas, their thoughts and observations based around a mystery that has been interpreted and reinterpreted.
Sure. And the thing is, too, it feels like sometimes a lot of people will take belief and they feel so strongly about something that it becomes factual to them.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think it's important to try and avoid that. I mean, people sometimes say to me, well, you know, you wrote this book and you mentioned, I mean, like, for example, I wrote one book on Roswell, and then in another book I presented a different theory, and people right. say, well, that's kind of fence-sitting. I said, well, no, it's not fence-sitting. What it's doing is demonstrating there are different people who claim to have been involved in the Roswell case who have presented different scenarios. You know, you've had some people who've said, you know, a UFO crashed with aliens from another planet. Well, there's a guy named Walter Bosley, who's former U.S. Air Force Office of Special Investigations. Walter, whose father was held a position, quite high position in the Air Force prior to him, said that he was told by his father that the Roswell crash involved some sort of ancient humanoid race, like a subterranean human race. Then you have sort of the secret experiment theory for Roswell, a military experiment. So in other words, it's, to me, it's not a case of, you know, jumping around and changing directions. It's a matter of, if we're dealing with a case that we admittedly don't know the answer to, you know, in my mind, clearly something unusual happened at Roswell. However, when there are multiple scenarios coming from military people, we have to address them all. We can't just say, I know the UFO angle is true, so I'm going to ignore everything else. We've got to look at all the other scenarios. And I think, particularly within ufology, people get confused. It's kind of like they expect you to fall into one camp and never veer away from it. You know, it's like, he's the abduction researcher, you know, she's the contactee investigator, he's a cattle mutilation researcher, and he believes cattle mutilations are done by this, she believes abductions are genetic experiments by aliens. And it's like they almost expect you to not veer away from that view. But for me, you know, I'm honest enough to admit we don't know what's going on, so I see nothing wrong with addressing multiple theories and writing about them, providing, like I said, that you make it clear to the reader that that's what you're doing.
Right. You're approaching it like a true skeptic. You're asking questions, you're presenting ideas, but you're not necessarily focusing in on just one and being like, this is the only path.
Yeah, but I think the problem is, within ufology, a lot of people don't want that. They want a definitive answer. You know, they don't want somebody who says at the end of the book, well, you know, this is where it seems to be leading, and this is where what the data suggests. They want to know that aliens crashed at Roswell.
Yeah.
Aliens may well have crashed at Roswell. You know, there are some really intriguing stories. They may well have crashed, but until we know for sure, we can never rule out the idea of, you know, it was this or it was that or it was something totally unforeseen that we haven't even thought of yet. People don't want that. They, you know, the problem is a lot of it becomes almost like a religion, you know, where belief does become, you know, fact. And, you know, I'm not knocking religion. I mean, if I don't care what people's religious beliefs are, as long as they don't, you know, force them on me.
Right.
You know, if somebody believes in this or believes in that, that's fine. But I think the important thing is they should understand that a belief in, say, for example, a heaven and a hell, or a belief in reincarnation, or a belief in purgatory, there's nothing wrong with believing all those, providing you realize it's a belief.
Right.
You know, I mean, I would accept the validity of purgatory if somebody could prove it to me. You know, in the meantime, I'm open-minded on all this kind of stuff and interested in it. But I can't, in all honesty, you know, endorse it as a fact until it goes from being a faith or a theory. And I think, well, no, I don't think. I mean, I know from you, from the perspective of ufology, from my perspective, that's how I try and approach the UFO subject or anything I write about, unless I know for sure that, you know, it's like if I write a book, as I've actually just finished a new one on the Loch Ness Monster, you know, that sort of looks at all the different theories. But until, or if one's washed up on the shore of Loch Ness one day, you know, we'll never know. We can only debate that it's a giant eel or it's a giant catfish or it's a plesiosaur. You know, we can look at all the theories and come up with the merits for yes or no. But like I said, until one washes up or gets harpooned or whatever, it's always going to be kind of like with the UFO subject. You know, the subjects might be different, but when you're dealing with the paranormal, the concepts and the theories and everything else, how we approach them are actually quite similar, really.
Yeah, yeah. The and it's very hard to prove a negative, too. It's hard to prove nothing. You know, it's very hard to prove that nothing happened at Roswell.
Well, that's right. Yeah, you're right. I mean, that's one of the big things that we also face. You know, people say, well, how do you prove it? You know, this did happen or didn't happen? And you really cannot. I mean, going back to Roswell, I mean, even the Air Force and the government admit that something came down, but they say that, you know, the wreckage was from something called a Mogul balloon, like
right.
a giant spy balloon, and they say the bodies were crash test dummies. But even by the Air Force's admission, they didn't find any documentation to support that. It was their theory based upon the nature of experiments that were going on at that time, and they thought, given the time frame and what was happening, that was probably the right answer. But, you know, even the Air Force went, look, the fact that they couldn't find any records on a UFO crash or any records that denied a UFO crash, even they were in that awkward position of saying, well, we didn't find anything. You know, we couldn't prove it wasn't a... When you lack evidence of something, it doesn't necessarily mean, you know, it's real or it isn't real. But you're right, then, you know, like you said, when you're trying to prove a negative or even prove a positive, you know, you have these sort of catch-22 situations where it becomes really difficult.
Yeah, yeah. So let's get back to your book a little bit here.
Sure.
When we're dealing with Sitchin, what was the specific thing in Sitchin's work that pointed to the Rh negative factor?
Well, yeah, I mean, like I said, for people who may not be aware of it, a small percentage of the human population has what's called Rh negative blood. And to give you sort of an idea, in, you know, the U.S. population, for Caucasians, it's about 12% of the population. For African Americans, it's about 7 or 8. And for Asian Americans, it's as low as 1 or 2. Now, essentially, it basically means that a small percentage of the population has blood that is significantly different to the rest of the population. And for the most part, it revolves around the fact that the Rh negatives lack a particular antigen or protein in the blood. But it's actually... goes far beyond that. For example, if you have, for example, a man who's Rh negative and a woman who's Rh positive and the woman gets pregnant, it can actually cause major problems if the blood of the pregnant woman and the growing fetus cross. The mother's immune system essentially tries to kill the unborn fetus. Because it perceives it as, no pun intended, it perceives it as being alien to her, foreign to her. And so that's why there are drugs today to combat this issue of the mother essentially trying to kill her own baby. But there are also physical differences in some cases with the Rh negative. So the big question is, you know, if the theory of evolution is 100% accurate, why should not we all be 100% Rh positive? Why should there be this small percentage that are significantly different, even to the point where, as I said, a pregnant mother can actually, you know, when the problems arise, or if problems arise, actually tries to kill, you know, her body tries to kill the unborn baby. Now, on the UFO angle in the present era, there are literally, well, I couldn't tell the figure, but I mean, I'll give you an example. When the book came out, Bloodline of the Gods, I think it was September, start of September, I received literally hundreds of reports, like messages, either on email, Twitter, Facebook, etc., my blog, from people who were reading the book or read it and said, well, you know, I'm Rh negative and I've had these experiences. The bulk of the people who contacted me were people, not just, you know, contactees or abductees of any particular group. Most of them were Rh negatives. And this is what it gets, sort of hammers home the point that the more you look into it, the more you find that although the percentage of the population who are Rh negative is extremely small, within ufology, the percentage of people who've had experiences and who are Rh negative is extremely high. You know, you would imagine it should be the other way around, that if the Rh negative figure in the overall population is lower, then that should also be reflected almost identically within UFO reports. You know, 10 to 12% of abductees should be Rh negative, but they're not. It's like massive figures. So that sort of demonstrates the situation today. But to get to your point of how and why it ties in with Sitchin and the distant past, is that if you look at the world situation with Rh negatives, pretty much the figures are the same everywhere, but there are certain hot spots where the figures are higher. Now, one of these is in portions of Spain and France where the Basque people live, which is Basque. Now, the Basque people, their figures, depending on the specific areas in France and Spain, but their figures are like 45 to 65% Rh negative, you know, which is like incredible figures compared to the rest of the world. And there are a few other hot spots like that as well. Now, what we find is that in these hotspot areas are also the areas where, beginning about 40,000 years ago, where Cro-Magnon man lived. And if you look at the Basque people, they actually do look quite different to the rest of us. They have sort of far more sort of robust bodies naturally, you know, not through bulking up and exercising, but naturally. They have sort of stronger jawline and more prominent forehead. And this has given rise to the idea with the Rh negative lineage running through them to a high degree, and the fact that the Cro-Magnons lived in that area, and also we find, you know, a growth of Rh negatives in other areas where the Cro-Magnons lived. This has given rise to the theory that probably that the Cro-Magnons themselves were Rh negatives. And if we look at, you know, the sort of the popular image, I guess, of so-called cavemen, as they're known. You know, you have this image of a guy dressed in sort of bear skins and a club in one hand and dragging his wife back to the cave by the hair in the other. You know, it's that kind of simplistic imagery. But in reality, the Cro-Magnons, you know, their brain capacity, well, not just their brain capacity, their brain size was significantly bigger than ours. Their brains are bigger than ours. They had a full understanding of the implications of death to the extent that they had burial rites. They were highly skilled artists. If you look at for example, the cave paintings in France, you know, those pictures sort of rival anything you would see on, you know, in an art gallery or a museum. They're sort of, you know, really good artwork of sort of, you know, animals racing across the plains and things like this. And we also, you know, there's good indications that they understood music as well. They had music. And so in that sense, they were highly evolved, yet they surfaced, I wouldn't say out of nowhere, but they surfaced very quickly with these highly evolved brains and cultures and beliefs, etc., etc. And so this sort of takes us back to Sitchin's stuff then, about how he believed, at least, that the Anunnaki came to the Earth and upgraded some of the very early primitive humans coming out of Africa and essentially genetically altered and upgraded them to something along the lines, or possibly even Cro-Magnon. So that, in other words, that is where you have the tie-in sort of from the present to the past. But of course, you know, as I point out, you have to sort of be accepting of the fact that that's the way it happened, that it wasn't due to some sort of just genetic mutation in the human species with no outside components, and it also requires an acceptance of Sitchin's theories, or at least something like them along those lines. But I mean, again, you know, it's difficult to try and, you know, find a fact to support this, except for, you know, if you look at a lot of ancient texts where they talk about the gods, supernatural entities coming down and mating with the human women, which leads into things like the Nephilim and, you know, the men mm-hmm. of renown and the giants, you know, that kind of thing. You can look at that from our perspective, from the idea of, you know, somebody from somewhere else came down, genetically altered or manipulated factions of the human population and created these so-called hybrids, you know, and then parallel it with today's stuff with hybrid children and, you know, the whole abduction thing, which relates to sort of reproduction and that kind of thing. So, you know, but again, the big question is, you know, to what extent is that scenario valid, or are we putting today's beliefs and scenarios and pushing them on the pact and interpreting them in a fashion that sort of ties in with what is accepted today? You know, that's always the big hazard, but unless you point out, you know, that it's a hazard rather than the gospel truth, so to speak.
Right.
No pun intended.
And you also have, like, Native American legends that talk of the sky people coming down and stuff like that on top of it.
Well, yeah, I mean, you can find pretty much all cultures around the world have these stories about sort of superior beings coming down, you know, in some cases acting in a very sort of violent, almost homicidal fashion, but in other ways, you know, sort of teaching, you know, if you look at mm-hmm. the you know, sort of Central America, like Quetzalcoatl, things like that, which, you know, was far from being like a War of the Worlds scenario. It's almost like this sort of a magical supernatural entity essentially sort of helping and teaching the human race. But then other people put a spin on, if you look at the stories of like Sodom and Gomorrah, that, you know, you have the theories that they were nuked yeah. by aliens, you know. So in other words, you can look at things from different perspectives, but one of the sort of overriding points, and you know, you made that good point with the Native Americans, is that cultures all around the world do talk about, in the distant past, entities from somewhere else visiting the earth, and that, you know, they took human wives, so to speak, and things like that. You know, even like, for example, the biblical story of Adam and Eve. Now, I know a lot of people who, you know, who have faith and who adhere to the literal account would obviously take it literally. But if you look at the, you know, the translations from the original texts, I mean, it actually says that Adam was placed into a state of great sleep, which kind of sounds like he was anaesthetized, and then his, you know, the whole issue of his rib being used to create the first woman. Well, to me, you know, you can interpret that as, you know, he was anaesthetized by, you know, medical personnel, and genetic material was taken from his body, which could have been utilized, you know, in some sort of a highly advanced gene splicing thing to upgrade an early type of primitive human. But over the thousands of years, it got sort of simplified because of the people of that era clearly wouldn't understand the science behind it, and it became mutated that God took Adam's rib, and lo and behold, the first woman comes into being. You know what I mean? You can look at it from that perspective, but again, we always have to be mindful of, I think, of how we do interpret things.
All right, we got to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Nick Redfern.
The opinions expressed by the host and guests on Where Did the Road Go are their own and not necessarily those of WVBR or its management. Where Did the Road Go can be heard first and usually live on WVBR, Saturday nights at 11 p.m. Eastern. Go to wheredidtheroadgo.com to ask questions of our live guests through the chat room. Where Did the Road Go is then re-aired on Dark Matter Radio and Deprogrammed Radio. You can download all shows for free on the website, and you can subscribe to us on Stitcher, iTunes, YouTube, or Vimeo. Additional content can be found on our video channels. You will also find our upcoming schedule, book reviews, blogs, free book downloads, links, and more. We are also on Facebook and Twitter, and if you want to help support the show, there are links to donate to us. Everything you need can be found at wheredidtheroadgo.com.
And tonight we're talking with Nick Redfern about his one of his latest books, Bloodline of the Gods. In this book, you talk about something that really, I think I might have heard about it at one point, but I guess it didn't sink in completely. But you talk about the Iraqis making a weapon to target only Arabs, particularly Iraqi Arabs.
Well, yeah, this is actually something that surfaced. The reason I knew about this is because I moved over to the US to live in 2001. But a couple of years before that, the British media, the mainstream media, began to report on a number of stories coming out of the Middle East about sort of very dark and disturbing research that was being done to create what we might call sort of like racially profiled viruses. The idea of being able to target one specific group of people, you know, which would be, you know, sort of very dark and disturbing if that, you know, it came to fruition and worked on a massive scale. You know, arguably, you could wipe out entire groups of people and, you know, there'd be no way to blame it on warfare. It'd just be, well, it was just a terrible virus that broke out. And, you know, just the mere fact that, never mind whether it could actually work or not, the mere fact that research is being done in that area, you know, I think is itself something to sort of, to be aware of. And, you know, could take us down some very dangerous paths. But I mean, but one of the reasons I mentioned that in the book is because, you know, you have these admittedly intriguing stories relating to how certain early humans like Neanderthal man, you know, just went from being high profile to gone, you know. And and that's something again that's been debated quite extensively in the ancient astronaut research community. The idea of ancient extraterrestrials coming to the Earth and wiping out, possibly with some sort of, you know, highly contagious virus, factions of, you know, different groups. For example, Cro-Magnon man, you know, actually, as I said, surfaced quickly, developed, and, you know, to a degree was absorbed into, you know, the Homo sapiens, who we are today. However, the Neanderthals, who also had, you know, large brains, they were highly advanced, you know, they had cultures. There's even some evidence that they actually built boats because remains of them being found on isolated islands, which they could only have got there via boat. You know, the idea of Neanderthal man sort of rowing, you know, something like the equivalent of Roman vessels across the ocean sounds bizarre, but that is actually where the evidence is leading. And which makes it even more puzzling to understand, given, you know, their advances and not this sort of typical image we have of cavemen. This sort of begs the question, how is it that they suddenly became extinct at the expense of others? And most students and experts of the whole Neanderthal and Cro-Magnon situations don't believe, you know, that it was sort of you know, just battles, turf wars, and, you know, Neanderthal man was wiped out by the Cro-Magnons. There's a lot of evidence that they, for the most part, actually kept away from each other. So that begs the question, what was it that wiped out the Neanderthals but didn't affect the Cro-Magnons? So, again, it's sort of a case of looking at an ancient mystery and seeing if there's anything in the modern era that could potentially at least offer some explanation as to how it could have happened, and something along the lines of these sort of racially profiled viruses or research into these areas, I should say, you know, might at least be some sort of an answer.
And you would think, honestly, that Israel should be the last country trying to do something like that.
Well, you know, I mean, we just don't know what goes behind the closed doors of anywhere, really.
Well, yeah,
I mean,
that's true.
I mean, one of the things I talk about in the book is how just a few years ago came out in Britain, and most of the British governments, you know, like the equivalent of the Congress and the Senate, most of them didn't even know that a number of sort of prestigious universities in the UK, a lot of very controversial research is being done on, for example, gene splicing and, human fetuses and that kind of thing. And, the whole idea of, almost going down that path of sort of splicing species, interspecies, gene splicing and seeing what the end result could be. And although, in the UK they do have stringent laws as to how long, particularly like, for example, embryos, most of the work has been done on embryos. But, they have stringent laws as to how long these embryos can be kept alive to allow this sort of almost Frankenstein-like research to go on. But there have been rumors that, people have flouted the law and they've continued these experiments long before the extremely short period, actually, that they're not supposed to. And, there's sort of uproar in the British Parliament when it came out that what was actually going on. So, in other words, this demonstrates that, it's not just like, for example, terrorist groups that might want to get their hands on a racial virus, if you like. It's actually being done in the universities of nations that are friends of the US, and even to the point where I said most of the people in the British government knew nothing about it. They were asking questions in Parliament as to what the hell's going on, that kind of thing.
Let's move up to the present type of stuff. There's a lot of stuff in this book. We're just barely skimming the surface of this. But when you're talking about modern day abductions, I guess I have a hard time connecting modern day abductions with the Anunnaki. I mean, it's obviously not impossible, but it seems like the modern day phenomena may not be as physical as an ancient alien type of a thing.
Yeah. I mean, I point this out in the book. I mean, the one big difference, more than anything else, that we get in the story, if you look at stuff, for example, like Sitchin's work, he's talking about a world, almost like a worldwide control of the planet by the Anunnaki, where, their presence would have been known to all of the early humans, because this was some sort of gigantic operation, if you see what I mean. But obviously today, we're not seeing that at all. What we're seeing today is a situation where abductions are very much stealthy, you see what I mean? Mm-hmm. And so in that perspective, clearly something has changed. If in the distant past, 40, 50,000 years ago, maybe more, as Sitchin suggested, the Anunnaki were the rulers of the planet, well, they're clearly not the rulers of the planet now because we're not seeing them.
Right.
However, what's interesting is that there is a high proliferation of Rh negatives within the abduction community.
Right.
As I mentioned earlier, the sheer number of people who contacted me after the book came out. Also, the incredible number of people who got the book from Warwick Associates who have radio shows, and how many of the hosts are Rh negative as well. I mean, I should have really written it down, but I mean, I think of probably the 40 or 50 interviews I've done for the book on radio shows since it came out at the end of August, start of September, I think something like 14, 15, maybe close to 20 of the hosts were Rh negative, and they'd had lifelong interests and obsessions with UFOs as well. And there are somewhere in the region like 5 or 6 witness accounts in the book, witness interviews of people who were Rh negative and had abduction experiences, and even claims have had sort of follow-up abductions from military personnel trying to get a handle on this whole blood angle. So, I mean, I specifically point out in the book that, we're seeing something very different today to the distant past, even if Sitchin was correct. We're not seeing, massive armadas of Anunnaki craft, using the human race as slaves. There's just no evidence that's going on at all, because it clearly isn't. But I do sort of speculate on the idea, well, what if, whether the Anunnaki or somebody else, that they themselves degraded to the point where, today they're just sort of the last remnants, and that's why, they the whole angle has been scaled down, that maybe the abduction thing today is not about creating a slave race. It might be almost as if the tables have been turned, and ironically, they're reliant on our genetic materials to try and keep themselves alive. You know, whereas in the past, the genetic operations may have been done to create a slave race. Today, if they're on their last legs, we might be, or our genes might be the last sort of, you know, thing that keeps them alive. But again, it's speculative. But, you know, as I said, I try and point out the fact that we can take the Rh negatives and the Cro-Magnons back, you know, to early years, but and then point out we do have a significant number of Rh negatives in the abduction world today. So that, you know, even I have to admit, that's the closest connection we have. But it is interesting, you know, that the Rh negatives do pop up in both scenarios.
Now, do people who have Rh negative blood also have more paranormal encounters, or is it just UFOs?
No, there's actually a lot of studies have been done on people who are Rh negative, and it's not just UFO encounters, but they, you know, their sort of psychic abilities reportedly, they have a sort of a deep concern about the planet and the environment. A lot of vegetarians who are Rh negative. And also some physical issues, for example, having lower than normal blood pressure, lower than normal pulse rate, not, you know, obviously dangerously low, but, you know, like with your blood pressure, I think normal is roughly around about 120 over 80. You know, the Rh negatives, you know, it can be sort of 110 over 72 or something like that, which, you know, is actually really good if you're slightly lower than normal.
Right.
And as I said, there's this really weird issue of how major problems can happen if you have a, you know, parents, one's Rh negative, one's Rh positive, and the, you know, the blood of the unborn fetus mixes with the mother, and then the mother's body tries to literally kill the baby. You know, I'm not exaggerating when I say tries to kill it. That's literally what it tries to do. You know, as if it's not meant to be in her body. You know, and again, why, if nature, you know, has developed the way it has, or we're told it has, why on earth would there even be a situation where a mother's body would even want to try and kill the baby?
Yeah.
You know, it sort of goes against the you know, the way in which we have developed and you know, all animals develop, you know. So, you know, there's a lot of sort of strands and ideas and concepts and thoughts here. And I said, you know, to go back to the beginning about why did I write the book, one of the main reasons I wrote it was because, you know, if you search Rh negative blood on the internet, certainly you'll find a lot of material, just regular medical material, you know, it's just regular medical sites about what it actually is and, you know, particularly the problems with pregnancy and that kind of thing. However, there hadn't really been much written other than a few articles here and there about the relationship to UFOs. So, in other words, the main reason I wrote the book was to hopefully sort of share this story with a bigger audience, and maybe that will then sort of push people to look into it further, and, you know, we may get more answers. And I think that's probably the best way to do it. You know, when something kind of goes under the radar for so long, and most people, even within ufology, I found, you know, a lot of people didn't know about this at all. You know, they've been in ufology for years, and obviously they knew about abductions and the genetic angle, but they weren't specifically aware of this alleged Rh negative connection to it all. So the things that push me to hope that it might spur other people on to look into it and, you know, perhaps find other trends and links that, you know, people like me and other people didn't think of or didn't even notice, you know.
I would think another possibility, too, is that the Rh negative factor may allow people to access other realities easier, which is, you know, why I was asking about, like, psychic phenomena and stuff like that.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, this actually gets to the heart of some of the abduction stories. I mean, you know, a lot of people take the view that abductions are just purely and simply physical events, you know what I mean?
Right.
Where somebody's taken on board a craft and, you know, eggs or sperm or body cells are removed, that kind of thing. However, you know, you can look at some of these abductions and they almost seem to have occurred in almost like an altered reality, if you like, or an altered state of mind. I mean, you only have to look at the parallels between certain abduction cases of people, for example, who've been are under the influence of DMT, the spirit molecule.
Right.
You know, you can find a lot of people who've, you know, under DMT, and they've had extremely similar experiences with seeing these sort of small insectoid-like creatures that surface, you know, when they're in that altered state. Now, of course, the skeptic might say, well, it's just because their mind's altered. I actually think there's an extremely strong probability that when you're sort of under the influence of something like DMT, your brain is actually opening up to another reality that we don't see, you know, in our normal state.
Right.
You know, kind of like, you know, if you're walking around, you don't see ultraviolet rays, you don't see infrared rays, you don't see X-rays. You know, you don't hear a dog's whistle, but the dog hears it, you know, and the dog hears things we don't hear. You can have electric eels, which, you know, can electrocute their prey. You know, there are aspects to life that we as humans don't see, don't hear, don't recognize, but maybe in an altered state, we would recognize them. And I think you can sort of push the barriers back even further with these sort of altered state scenarios of, like DMT, for example. You can go back to things, you know, thousands of years ago, like the incubus and the succubus.
Yeah.
And like Lilith, which, you know, I talk about all this in the book, the idea of, you know, sort of supernatural entities that in many respects, you know, act quite like the so-called greys of ufology today. You know, people are woken up in the middle of the night and there's this paranormal presence, and, you know, there's always a sexual reproductive component to these events. The people feel paralyzed and, you know, something's got control of them. But, you know, 1,000 years ago, it's demons. Then it's sort of, you know, goblins and things like that. And today it's the greys. So, you know, I think where I differ to a lot of people in ufology who think you know, the whole UFO phenomenon is just nuts and bolts, I actually don't think it is. I think there's a more stranger aspect to this, and a lot of it relates to what we perceive as reality and what we don't perceive as reality. And I think there are realities around us that we don't see in our natural state. You know, it's like the, you know, the average shaman in a, I don't know, South American jungle little village. You know, I don't believe these people, you know, when they get themselves into an altered state by taking, you know, ingesting some local root, you know, or plant in the town, I don't think they're hallucinating. I think they are literally opening a door to somewhere else. And I think some of these abduction experiences may not actually be physical. It could be the case that the person's, you know, if you were in the room with them, they would still be in bed, you know, just looking fast asleep.
Right.
But possibly something in their mind opens them up to something where, you know, these entities can literally possibly intrude upon the dream state and contact us, if you like.
And I've said for a long time, I think the solution to the UFO phenomena isn't going to, we're not going to find it short of redefining what we understand as reality. I think that's where we get stuck, is that our view of reality is not compatible with what we're experiencing.
No, you're right. I mean, a classic example, you know, a lot of people, I know because I get to speak to them, you know, a lot of people, particularly researchers and authors, they're very much stuck in the idea of it's just nuts and bolts aliens, you know, going back to the whole ideas of like people like Donald Kehoe back in the 50s, you know, it's just nuts and bolts aliens and they've crashed and we've got bodies. And, well, maybe we have, but it's far more than that, because what I found, and I could say this to me and pretty much all the, you know, my friends and colleagues in the field, you start to dig into this and you begin to get like weird synchronicities in your life and things like that happen. Now, if this is just somebody else's equivalent of NASA, you wouldn't have that, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You wouldn't have weird synchronicities happen. You wouldn't have all the other strange stuff that goes on. So to me, there's far more to it. And I think, you know, I would agree with that. I don't understand, I'll be the first to admit, I don't understand how or why, but you're right that there is something about reality that we're not seeing. You know, our reality is our reality, but it's not all there is to reality. You know, and I think this whole issue of like DMT and hallucinogenics opening doorways, rather than, as you know, the cynic would say, well, they're just high and they're hallucinating. No, it's not. It's far from being that simple. And I think whatever these entities are, I think they understand how to operate in the physical world, and they understand how to operate in what, I guess in simple terms, we might call like a spirit world. You know, they can operate in a non-physical fashion, and that may even include sort of intruded upon us in that sort of dreamlike state. And maybe they do it to try and share information, or possibly even, you know, that it's almost like a creating a meme of abductions. Maybe there's something else going on, and they want to, you know, present themselves in a way that is understandable to the people of this era, you know, without blowing our minds. Let's slowly, you know, acclimatize them to the idea that something's going on. I think, you know, that's maybe why, if there are people in government who know, you know, a lot of people like me, they take the view that, oh, the government's the bad guys, you know, the CIA's the bad guys or whatever. I actually don't think that. I think that if we were to talk to the people who I do believe, you know, there probably is a small group within the official world that knows a lot more than the rest. You know, we're not talking about Project Blue Book or anything like
right,
that, but
right.
Like a really deeply buried group. I actually think they're in a, you know, I have a lot of sympathy for them. I think they're in a deeply awkward situation where they probably are conflicted over should we tell people or not. But I think the reason they don't isn't because, you know, so many people think, oh, they're the bad guys because of the CIA, so they've got to be the bad guys. I don't agree with that at all. What I think is that probably are in a really awkward situation because they know something really strange is going on, but it's far stranger than they ever expected it to be. And
yeah.
They just don't know how. I just honestly think they're not covering up for the technology, or because they just don't want to tell us. I think they're hiding it because they just don't know how to tell us. It'd be so life-changing and paradigm-changing. They just don't know how to tell us. And if they should tell us for our own good, maybe. That's the way they look at it, even.
And it may be that they don't really understand it any better than we do.
No, I think they don't. They may have a lot more data than
right.
we do, and they may even have bodies, who knows. But, you know, just because you might have 7 or 8 sort of still slowly decomposing bodies in tanks, you know, glass tanks that were recovered 70 years ago in Roswell, just because you've got that doesn't necessarily tell you what they are or where they're from or what they want.
Right.
It just means somebody was skulking around, they crashed, and we recovered the material, and we haven't really learned much about them since. So we've just kind of put it away somewhere, kind of like the last, you know, images in Raiders of the Lost Ark, you know, that kind of situation. But I actually think they are in an awkward situation where they know the truth is far weirder. And I really do think that if it was just somebody else's NASA, we probably would have been told. But I think when they looked into it and they probably started, ironically, the same kind of conversations we're having now, noting parallels between like out-of-body experiences and abductions with, you know, like, for example, the incubus and the succubus.
Yeah.
And then they realized that now this goes beyond weird. We can't tell. It's best just not to say anything to it. You know, we're just clamped down on it.
The thing is, it has an obvious physical component. I mean, there are physical traces, there are marks on people's bodies and things like that, but it also is just as much, it has an effect on consciousness as well as it does on the physical. So, I mean, there's a dual level there that you can't get away from.
Well, that actually comes to one of the most important things, you know, that so many people who've had UFO experiences, it transforms them in different ways.
Yeah.
And I think that could be one of the concerns that, you know, people in government or whoever this, you know, some theoretical agency is that's hiding all this. I think that's their big concern, is the way in which the phenomenon impacts on people and possibly like overnight alters their lives. I mean, you read, for example, like Whitley Strieber's books, you know, like Communion, how, you know, he went from being a horror writer to then having these experiences, and then suddenly his life is transformed. You find people who, you know, they have abduction experiences, and, you know, they become vegetarian overnight, or they feel they're on a mission to share their experiences, and they write books, they go on the lecture circuit. You know, I think that's the thing that is so fascinating about the subject. But I could also understand how there might be some people, particularly in government, who'd be worried by it. The fact that it's not just people see UFOs. They're altered by the exposure to the phenomenon, and I think that could possibly get to the heart of it all, is, you know, the way which people are perhaps sometimes, like, you know, almost immediately altered by exposure to it.
And we're talking here with Red... I almost called you Rick Medfern.
You're not the first one. Not the first one to do that, actually. Well, Micah Hanks is always making a joke.
Yes.
About it.
Micah told me to call you that early on, and I just didn't. And then I almost just did on accident.
Yeah, well, that's the problem. It's like Micah puts it out there on purpose. Like, it's kind of trying. You know, somebody says, "Don't think about a pink elephant." You know what I mean? It's like it's stuck in your mind, Ben. You know what I mean? But yeah, if Micah's listening, he does it. Micah's a good friend, but I know he does it on purpose.
One of the things I wanted to ask you about is this military abduction phenomenon. Mm. Now, do we know for sure that it is the military? Has anyone been able to prove it's the military, or could it possibly be another aspect of the phenomenon?
Well, that's a good point. I mean, you know, there's one of the things I point out in the book is that there are a few files on abductees. I mean, a lot of people don't realize, you know, there are Air Force files from the early 60s on the Betty and Barney Hill case. They're not extensive, but, you know, there's sort of 7 or 8 pages, and even Barney himself said that when him and Betty were interviewed, that, you know, they were put on the phone to other people outside of the, you know, the sort of lower level investigation, and they didn't know who they were talking to. And there are other cases where, yeah, I mean, I've interviewed people who you know, had abduction experiences, and then who said they were sort of followed up afterwards with sort of military abductions, or MILABs as they become known, you know, as if they're trying to figure out what's going on as well. Now, there are two ways of looking at this. One is the idea of, you know, literally some sort of covert black ops unit that possibly, you know, operates outside of the regular military, and whose entire job is based around following the abductees and interviewing them or interrogating them, etc., etc. Another interesting angle is that what if the sort of these MILABs are actually almost like a sophisticated hologram or something, you know, created in the mind's eye, so to speak, by the entities themselves,
mm-hmm.
Possibly to confuse the situation or to make it look like, you know, as bizarre as it sounds, like the government's doing it, but when it may, you know, they may be trying to just confuse the situation. But, I mean, I've got to say, I've interviewed over the... I'm going to include a couple of these stories in the book, but I've interviewed probably 15 or 20 people who claimed abductions at the hands of so-called greys, and then follow-up abductions where the people were sort of drugged and then questioned about their experiences. So, you know, there's been a couple of books written on that subject, but again, you know, there's... I think that particular topic really sort of really would lend itself, you know, to sort of a good sort of, you know, 300-page book that really got all the stories out and the theories and ideas. But because again, it's one probably a lot of people know about, but and as I said, there are a couple of small books on it, but you know, somebody really should address that whole angle to a, you know, to a bigger degree, really.
And along with that comes the black helicopter phenomenon.
Yeah. Well, again, you know, that sort of, you know, you can sort of go both ways with that. For example, I mean, I've interviewed people who, abductees, who've seen these black helicopters flying over their homes, and, you know, they felt they were clearly being monitored. But then I've spoken to other abductees who said they've seen these black helicopters, and as they've looked at it, it sort of literally transformed into like a UFO, or it's vanished in the sky. Or they felt it was like a hologram, that it wasn't even real. It was like somebody was trying to create an image of a helicopter, which really goes down some very odd areas. The idea that, you know, we assume they're black helicopters, you know, flown by some covert group, when, you know, it's actually something completely different. So, you know, I've come across sort of both sides of the coin with that. You know, are we dealing with literal black helicopters from some covert group, or is it like some of the people think, like an alien-driven hologram? But for what purpose? That's the big issue. I mean, who knows? But, you know, it's like with the, you know, the MILABs, that there's always sort of two sides of the coin, which frustratingly from our perspective doesn't actually help you answer the questions. It just gives you more questions to ask, you know.
That is the nature of this, I think.
Well, it is, yeah. It's like you think, you know, when you're looking into something, you get a bunch of information, but almost typically it does sort of push you down the path of, well, you know, when I started looking at this, I had 10 questions. Now I've got 50 questions rather than 10 answers.
And you connect in the kind of hybrid thing, too. I mean, which we see all the way back into the fairy faith, you know, with changelings and stuff. And then, of course, yeah. Bud Hopkins' work, you cover a little bit of that, right into the black-eyed children.
Yeah, I mean, this is, you know, the whole point, again, was to sort of look at the genetic angle, as it allegedly, at least, is going on. And, yeah, if you look back to sort of Betty and Barney Hill from the early 60s, 61, 62, and then reports from the 70s, and then through the early to mid-80s, you know, there was like a genetic sexual component, but it was primarily based around missing time. However, it was sort of in the 80s, sort of mid to late 80s onwards, and certainly through the early to mid-90s, when they were sort of far more graphically sexual and genetically related. And then you had sort of the rise of people claiming to have seen like hybrid babies and hybrid children on board craft, and where the abductees were allegedly, you know, told to try and communicate and interact with them to, as if the Greys couldn't understand how to, you know, be good parents, so to speak, as if they didn't even understand the concept of how or even why they should interact with them, but they knew they had to be interacted with, and so they used, you know, the abductees. And then, of course, from there, you have these stories of so-called star children, like highly gifted children. And at the other sort of end of the spectrum, you've got the far more sinister so-called black-eyed children, these sort of pale-faced, literally totally black-eyed, skinny little kids that come out at night dressed in black fedoras. You know, it kind of sounds like the script of one of those movies you see on the Sci-Fi Channel, you know, on a Saturday night or whatever, except for the fact that, you know, there's literally dozens of people who claim to have seen these black-eyed children. But, yeah, you make a good point. And, again, this sort of why I wanted to bring this in the book is because if you try, or you demonstrate there's a potential case to show this has ancient origins, you're right. You know, you can find in fairy lore in Europe, for example, you know, the fairies would steal, which were little people. You know, the fairies are the wee people, you know, the wee folk, that kind of thing. They would steal babies, break into people's homes at night, steal babies, and they would leave these so-called changelings, like a badly sort of carved or created effigy of a person or a baby, and they would steal the babies. You can find stories, you know, going back, for example, like Lilith, you know, stories that go back millennia, you know, where Lilith was seen as like a threat to newborn babies. You know, you can find these stories everywhere where you have magical supernatural beings, and certainly, you know, in the Middle Ages, 15th, 16th century, with the whole fairy lore and the little people, you know, a lot of those stories are linked with people, like I said, babies being stolen, missing time, you know, men walking through the woods in the 1500s in England, and they suddenly see these so-called fairy lights, which you could interpret as a UFO, and then they're taken to the fairy kingdom, where they, you know, they're told that the fairy queen, you know, the race is blighted, and they need to, you know, have new stock, new blood from us. So they, you know, the guy has sex with the fairy queen, and then he's returned to our world, and he thinks, you know, 2 hours has gone by and 3 days has gone by. You can find stories like that throughout fairy lore and mythology going back 400, 500, 600 years. And they're almost identical to today's abduction stories. You know, you just change the term the Greys for the fairies. And other than that, there's really not much difference.
Yeah. And I think, though, when you look at the hybrids seem to be harmless, whereas the black-eyed children, on the other hand, seem to have this malevolence about them.
Yeah, well, I actually wrote about this the other day. There's a lot of parallels between the men in black and the black-eyed children. In fact, David Weatherly, who wrote the Black-Eyed Children book, David wrote a 20-page paper for my newest book, which is just called Men in Black. And David's paper is solely based around the parallels between the Men in Black mystery and the Black Eyed Children. Like, for example, you know, the Men in Black, they wear black suits and fedoras. Well, the Black Eyed Children wear black hoodies, so they've got like a black outfit, and there's even the hat component, but it's like a hoodie.
Yeah.
They, you know, both have very pale skin. They typically only mainly surface at night, and they try and find their way into people's homes. That's one of the most typical components of both the MIB and the Black Eyed Children story. They try and get into the house. So you do have a lot of parallels between the Black Eyed Children and the Men in Black, and this has sort of given rise to one of the theories. It's actually on an upswing right now, the idea that these hybrids are sort of infiltrating us. You know, and when I say infiltrating, I do mean from like a sinister perspective, you know, that they're trying to synthesize a form of alien that looks more and more like us with every generation, and it can sort of, you know, move amongst us. And, you know, if they wear hats and they wear sunglasses and they come out at night when it's a bit darker, you probably wouldn't notice the subtle, or perhaps sometimes less than subtle, differences. But, you know, maybe sometimes the reason people see them is because they're actually testing to see if they're noticed. You know, that's one of the interesting theories, that the reason for them actually being seen is not because they're actually doing something. It's just to see if people are able to make a differentiation between them and us, so to speak. So, but, you know, regardless of what people think of it, you can find throughout history and, you know, numerous nations extremely, you know, similar stories of, like I said, hybrid children and magical children and babies being stolen and missing time and all these things.
Yeah, yeah. All right. So again, the book is Bloodline of the Gods: Unravel the Mystery of the Human Blood Type to Reveal the Aliens Among Us. And this is one of three you have out now, and you want to tell people what the other two are?
Yeah, well, one's called, as I just said, Men in Black. I've actually done two previous books on the Men in Black, one called On the Trail of the Saucer Spies and The Real Men in Black. But the new one, which is just called Men in Black, that's just been out about a month. And it's basically about 30 chapters, which is a combination of all the most recent interviews I've done with people who've had MIB encounters. And then about a third of the book is papers that I commissioned from various well-known people in ufology, like, for example, Micah Hanks. Micah did a cool article about his perspectives on the Men in Black, and David Weatherly did one on, you know, the parallels between the Black Eyed Children and the MIB. Brad Steiger did a paper as well, and numerous other people, well-known people in ufology, all sort of addressing the Men in Black phenomenon from their own perspective. So it's it's sort of all the latest case files that I have on the Men in Black, and theories and papers from people in the field as well. And the other one, which is called Chupacabra Road Trip, which has been out about 2 months now, that's my other big interest, is cryptozoology, the study of unknown animals. And I've been on a lot of expeditions to Puerto Rico looking for the Chupacabra, and also the reports out of the U.S. and Mexico and Central America. So it's basically like a road trip style book, you know, written in the spirit of a road trip, which is the way I do all the investigation. You know, you hit the road and look for these things. So somebody described it as a cross between The X-Files meets Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, which if you read the book, it's probably fairly close. You know, it's sort of all about, you know, hitting Puerto Rico and hunting for the Chupacabra in the day, then hanging out at the bar, knocking back margaritas and disgusting all your findings at night, you know, that kind of thing. So.
All right, and you're working on one, you said, on Loch Ness?
Yeah, I've actually just wrapped that up, a book on the Loch Ness Monster, which will be out at some point in 2016, and also a book which actually relates to what we've been talking about with the Men in Black and the Black Eyed Children. One of the sort of lesser known aspects of the whole or the overall Men in Black mystery are Women in Black reports, which are actually extremely similar to the Men in Black, and they kind of dress the same, have pale skin and threaten people. And I've got literally, I would say somewhere in the region of probably 40 or 50 Women in Black reports going back to the 40s to the present day. So wow. I'll have a book out on that subject in 2016 as well. And, you know, they're sort of really kind of creepy stories that sort of cross over ufology and also, you know, sort of ghostly paranormal stories as well. There's always kind of an aspect to, even if it seems like a definitive UFO story, there are, you know, some certain paranormal aspects to these Women in Black stories as well.
Oh, that's really interesting. I'd never heard of the Women in Black. I mean, aside from the ghost, you know, mention of the you know, woman in black and stuff.
Yeah, well, actually, I usually get two things. You know, people say, oh, you're writing a book about the Woman in Black, you know, the movie, the novel. Say, no, or they think I'm writing a book about goth girls, you know. I said, well, it actually kind of did a little bit of both, but, you know, but with a UFO angle to it. But yeah, it's, you know, it is one of these areas that has been sort of very much gone under the radar, and that's one of the reasons I wanted to write it again, like with the previous book, was because you want to bring something new for the reader to read.
Yeah.
And also, you know, it's a valid area that I think people need to know about if you're interested in all this stuff, because, like, you know, a lot of people just don't know about it. They just don't realize there is even a Women in Black phenomenon.
At what point are you going to surpass Brad Steiger in sheer number of books?
Well, I actually don't think that will ever happen. I mean, I've done about 33, and with the ones I've completed and working on, that will put it close to sort of 40. But I mean, Brad now, I think Brad's a good friend of mine. We were talking about this, you know, some time ago, and because we did a book together called The Zombie Book a couple of years ago. Mm-hmm. And Brad is now up to like 190 or 185 or something. And unless I live to be like 200, you know, there's no way I'm going to reach 185 books. So.
Well, to be fair, though, his books were fairly short, especially back in the 70s. You'd pick it up, it'd be a small paperback, barely 100 pages, whereas yours, like this one, clocks in at, you know, 230 pages of data here.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I guess that's true. I mean, I actually, you know, I was a kid in the 70s, you know, a little kid, and I used to like those books, you know.
Oh, yeah.
That book got me interested, sort of Brad's early stuff, like Strangers from the Skies, and I remember where I used to live, there was a used bookstore, and I used to go in there when I was like 11 or 12, and you know, I'd find these old crumpled paperbacks that Brad wrote from like 1967 and 68, and you know, for when you're sort of a kid that age, you find them. It was like, you know, walking into like a treasure trove.
Uh-huh.
You know what I mean? And
definitely.
But yeah, I seriously, you know, don't think I'm going to reach 185 books. But I mean, you know, I write books, so I enjoy it, and I like to present something new to people. You know, and if I only did another 5 or 10, if I felt I'd achieve what I felt all I wanted to achieve, you know, I wouldn't feel a need just to keep doing it, you know what I mean?
Yeah, so, yeah. All right, well, thank you, Nick. You're going to stick around and do a little segment for our patrons, and right now, though, we're going to take you out with some Psyche Corporation. This is Strange Machine. J'abandonne mes chimères.
Stars, they brew just my view.